For almost 2,000 years, the Catholic Church has pointed the way towards salvation through Jesus Christ. For each of us, that journey starts in darkness, as if in a cave. Or in the words of Paul, at present we see indistinctly, as in a mirror, but then face to face. We invite you now to come with us as we seek wisdom and truth by way of faith and reason with your guides Mark Tuttle and Timothy O'Donnell. Join us in the Catholic Cave. Welcome once again to the Catholic Cave. I'm Kent Blanford. With me in the cave, Mr. Mark Tuttle and Mr. Timothy O'Donnell. We recently had the opportunity to reconnect with Dr. Peter Redpath, and we'll return to the cave with that interview right after this. You're listening to Catholic Radio Indy, converting the culture to Christ through radio, featuring 100% Catholic programming 24/7. Do your friends a favor. Tell them about Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm still Timothy O'Donnell, and in the cave is still our trusty companions, Mark Tuttle and Kent Blanford. And we are delighted, though, to welcome a special guest back to the show. If you listen to the Catholic Cave with any regularity, you'll recognize his name, his voice, and his insights, Dr. Peter Redpath. Welcome to the cave, Dr. Redpath.
Thank you, Timothy and Mark, Kent. I appreciate it once again.
Well, thank you. I know you've got to get up kind of early to be in the cave, so we really appreciate it and delighted to have you because you are super busy with a ton of different initiatives, including educational initiatives, conferences, and books. And so I think what I want to do is I want to jump right in. Dr. Redpath, you've been on the show before. You're the rector at the Adler Aquinas Institute. You also have founded and you lead the Aquinas Leadership Institute. You've got online programs through Holy Apostles College and Seminary. You've got decades of writings and books and speaking engagements. So let me begin with maybe one of your latest projects that I have the privilege of you previewing to me, which is you've just released a second volume on metaphysics. And so tell us a little bit about that book. What's it called, and what's sort of what's the project that you're involved in there?
Well, the second volume is of a what I entitled the Not So Elementary Christian Metaphysics. It's kind of a spoof on Father Owens's Joseph Owens's an elementary Christian metaphysics, which. Was not so elementary.
Right. I think your title, having read the first and a lot of the second volume, it is not so elementary. Boy, is it great, though.
But I tell you what, for the sake of our listeners a little bit, I think a lot of people, when they hear the term metaphysics, they think of that section in the book.
Which Barnes & Noble.
Right, where you wind up with
the Buddha and the nasal gate.
Right, witchcraft and things like
right.
that. When we're talking...
Lord, we don't want that.
No, when we're talking philosophical metaphysics and we're talking... particularly Christian metaphysics. What exactly were we talking about?
Well, I have an understanding of what the ancient Greeks meant by metaphysics. It's radically different from pretty much anybody else. because I had come across a statement by Father Armand Maurer years ago in a work that he had written for the 70th centenary anniversary of the death of St. Thomas in 1974, which was on the St. Thomas and the Nominalist, on the Unity of the Sciences, subtitled St. Thomas and the Nominalist, where Father Maurer said that the subject of a science, what St. Thomas meant by a science, was not a system or body of knowledge. That the genus, that science studies the genus, according to St. Thomas, and the genus, he says, of the philosopher, or of the scientist, because St. Thomas understood the terms to be identical, is not the genus of the logician, but is something, it's a habit of the soul.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So it's more like developing a virtue rather than necessarily, you know, diving in and I guess studying a science as we would think about studying it.
It's not a collection of propositions or logical premises. It's not a body of knowledge, huh? But it's a habit of the soul capable of generating a single understanding of a multitude of things, which well, I realize the implications of what Father Maurer had said there, because most students of St. Thomas during the 20th century and after Leo XIII came out with his Aeterni Patris encyclical had considered philosophy chiefly to be a body of knowledge. It was either a single philosophy that everybody in the Middle Ages held that was, you know, scholastic philosophy or something like this was a popular understanding right after Leo's encyclical. And then during the 20th century, they started to realize, no, that philosophy was something different. And this statement by Father Maurer is very important because if philosophy is chiefly a habit of the soul, then philosophy is chiefly a psychology.
Right, right. Yeah, and we kind
and
of.
I actually hadn't realized, got the full implications of that until I finished this second volume of a not so elementary Christian metaphysics, which I had been chiefly motivated to write in order to reunite philosophy and science and wisdom to establish a new metaphysics, and follow that up with a new understanding of St. Thomas' teaching about ethics that could replace the metaphysics and the ethical teaching that are at the foundation of the Enlightenment.
Yeah, we think about...
there we go. Yeah, okay.
And we think about other disciplines somewhat in light, I think, of what you're trying to say. So we think about law, or we think about engineering, as not necessarily just a body of knowledge, but a sort of... a disciplined habit of the way of approaching the world. Lawyers and engineers think differently about things, and part of going to law school, part of going to engineering school, is becoming inculcated in the way a lawyer approaches the world or the way an engineer approaches the world. Is that the kind of thing you're saying about metaphysics?
In other words, St. Thomas considers the genus to be a whole. An integral whole, a whole made up of parts, and so different sciences study different part whole relationships, and they do so from different habits of interest, intellectual and volitional and emotional interests. So the science consists of the thing known and the way it's known, of the organization you're studying, which is qualitatively different from other kinds of organizations. St. Thomas says at the beginning of his Summa Contra Gentiles and also at the beginning of his commentary on Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics that he says in the Summa Contra Gentiles, the office of the wise man is to study order, to know order. You take your understanding of order, you get it from the nature of an end, and the intellect, according, he says in his commentary on the metaphysics of Aristotle, of the Nicomachean Ethics of Aristotle, knows order, knows the ends of things, the relationship of one thing to another to an end. If you get rid of the notion of ends, if you get rid of the notion of of a faculty psychology, that lies at the foundation for having intrinsic abilities to know, like the faculty of seeing, the faculty of hearing, for example, abilities, right, that are capable of generating an understanding of different wholes, organizations. You can't make intelligible what science is. It becomes impossible.
Is that the crisis that we're in, metaphysically speaking, and yes, the crisis that you're then trying to offer either a corrective or a replacement
Eckhart wrote his discourse on the method and the...
I remember you bringing up Descartes on previous shows. I think you barbecued him, Dr. Redpath. We often barbecued Descartes on this show, but I'm sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
He wrote his discourse on the method and his meditations on first philosophy. He dedicated the second work, and he had just published a few years later even though he'd finished it in 1628. In 1637, he published that discourse on the method, the one method supposedly for knowing the whole of science. He dedicated that the second work on Meditations on First Philosophy to the dean and the doctors of philosophy at the University of Paris, because he realized that to reestablish the foundations of science, he had to develop a new metaphysics. And Jacques Maritain, several decades ago, I read his work on the peasant of the Garonne, where he begged his readers to not to take the statement he was going to make to be the claim of a crazy old man, that modern philosophy, modern subjective idealism is not philosophy. That philosophy is something radically different.
Yeah, and you know the nature of when you look at modern philosophy, particularly when you look at Descartes and what he was doing, his meditative process of trying to get back to first principles by diving into himself, by looking at things subjectively, it does have more of a cast and a character of a religion, a set of religious beliefs, rather than a science or a studied discipline.
I might say they're even ideological, right? They're these ideological commitments that seem impervious to persuasion or argumentation at times, too. And so I also know, go ahead, Dr. Redpath.
It's a neo-Gnostic spiritualism. Descartes gets rid of the whole notion of the soul.
Yes.
Right,
He places it with a collection of ideas which somehow feel themselves together and have a common name. He's a nominalist. So there's no way that you can have a nominalistic science. The whole of modern philosophy, science, falsely so-called, is based upon nominalism. And nominalism denies the reality of real relationships.
Right.
Real universals.
Yeah. It's trying really to kind of plot the place of things within the universe on the sort of mathematical grid that's been laid over everything, and just kind of trying to plot where things are rather than diving into ends and what the natures of things are and how we can understand things. We're just sort of plotting them on this sort of mathematical physical grid.
Right. Yeah. What you, according to St. Thomas, though, at the beginning of his Summa Theologia, he says, that is in his section on his treatise on man, he says that the only way that you can have explain how one person knows many things is in terms of a person having a faculty of the soul, an intellectual faculty of the soul that has habits. That exist within that faculty, and the only way you can have one science is the extent that you're studying a limited number of things. And he claims that the knower and the thing known belong to the same genus. Now, there's nobody that exists today who is a scientist, as far as I know, who can make intelligible to you how that's possible. How one person can know many things, and how one science can, strictly speaking, study a limited number of things, and how both of them belong to the same genus, because they don't know what a genus is.
Right. And we don't even talk, I think, about psychology or about the makeup of the human person in terms of a faculty of the soul that can develop habits and virtue and all of that. So I guess since that's so strange to modern ears. I mean, I think those of us that have studied philosophy, it's not quite that foreign. But for a lot of people, that's almost a completely foreign language. What does it look like? What do the contours of the soul, I guess, look like a little bit when you start talking about, a faculty that's capable of developing a habit and a discipline?
Well, first of all, when people pride themselves on being philosophers or scientists, they're not priding themselves on the fact that they possess a collection of facts, that they somehow have it in their mind, right? Whatever they mean by a mind. They chiefly pride themselves on the fact that they have had this psychological ability to generate such a unique intellectual insight, a truth. They've discovered a truth. This truth in the mind or in the soul somehow is analogous to, represents what actually exists independently of the soul. And they've got this psychology that in some way has been able to recognize this relationship that exists in things, and they've had the power and ability to express it. Modern science today has more or less been reduced to a technologically regulated manipulation of the physical phenomenon, a mathematical technological ability to torture the physical universe and make it reveal its secrets.
I love that phrase that you just put out there for about using mathematics to torture nature to reveal its secrets. Hey, I want to take a quick second though, Dr. Redpath, to remind everyone that's who we're speaking with here in the Catholic Cave, Dr. Peter Redpath, author, speaker, rector, Aquinas Leadership Institute president, as well as you've got this new great new book out, Volume 2, Not So Elementary Christian Metaphysics. That's what we've been talking about. So I want to engage you over the because I think you're taking up these themes in your latest book. It has a subtitle, and I know you have a book on ethics we're going to get to too, but it has a subtitle, I believe, this Volume 2 on Christian Metaphysics called Ragamuffin Thomism. What do you mean by that? That's a very intriguing title. What do you mean by that?
St. Thomas, in his commentary on Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics, makes a distinction between two types of habits. A virtue formation habit, different habits of the soul, a virtue formation habit, and a virtue possession habit. And the virtue formation habit is the kind of habit with which most people who've developed any kinds of talents are familiar. That you have to exert a lot of effort, repeat a number of activities, and master them. Just to do something simple like becoming a talented tennis player or singer or professional athlete. And as you're going through that process, you have imperfect possession of that talent, and so you can fail. Very often you don't have it mastered, and the kind of pleasure, the quality of pleasure that you get from exerting the effort, from working hard, say from studying, you master the principles by which that's done. That's entirely different from the kind of skill that you get when you've mastered it, okay, and when you don't tend to fail, when you're on the top of your game, right. And ragamuffin ethics, metaphysics and ragamuffin ethics. I entitled this an introduction. The subtitle is an introduction to ragamuffin Thomism, because in my opinion, since Pope Leo came out with his encyclical, Thomism has been going through different stages where people have been realizing, trying to recover the teaching of St. Thomas, you had the initial groundbreaking stage in the 19th century, early 20th century. Then you had this 20th century development with people like Etienne Gilson and Father Eschmann and Jacques Maritain and so forth, and they were missing some principles that could more completely develop what St. Thomas was teaching, especially this insight that Father Maurer had about philosophy, science chiefly being a habit of the soul, and that it's chiefly an organizational psychology. Once you realize that what the ancient Greeks were talking about when they were talking about philosophy was an organizational psychology, a habit of soul that was fascinated by the existence of organizations and wanted to understand the nature of organizations, right? How this was their chief concern. It wasn't impossible dreams of pure reason or faith-seeking understanding or the Marxist dialectic of history. None of this.
We like to barbecue Marx from time to time on the show too. At least I do.
None of this.
Well, yeah. Well, and what you're bringing up, Dr. Redpath, are some of the predominant, if not worldviews, at least a lot of the predominant presuppositions that go into people's worldview, which has created the kind of crisis, I think, that you're trying to address through these various efforts that you've made in your writing, your speaking, your founding of institutes and conferences. So,
particularly the Thomas Aquinas Leadership Institute, I can see very clearly how trying to transform, I guess, this understanding of metaphysics would play into something like that.
We have a leadership deficit in the 21st century. And the leadership deficit is the result of centuries of misunderstanding, especially since the 17th century with the beginnings of modern philosophy, falsely so-called, has led to an inability to understand the nature of first principles and the application of principles to different multitudes, subjects of study, so that you can understand them in an organizational way, so you can understand the operation of organizations, which is what leaders do.
Well, it seems
we have an identity crisis in Western culture, where people who are professionals are largely incapable of identifying precisely what is the subject that they study, and how they can possibly claim to be a professional or this or that. The only area where there's this claim that this can be known with precision is in mathematical physics, supposedly. And then outside of that, there is no truth. There's this taffy pull. So you've got skepticism. And as a result of it, you have anarchy. And what our modern colleges and universities do is they teach. They teach this sophistry to students, inculcate them with this, and then wonder why it is that you have anarchists running our universities as well as our corporations, our international corporations, our colleges and universities.
Right, because without this sense of sort of an organized sense of the whole, you just wind up with people shouting at each other. You just wind up with no real ability to have, I think, a common purpose to even have a conversation.
And if you keep shouting at me, I'm going to need a safe space here in the cave.
Right.
Here's my observation, Dr. Redpath. Tell me if I'm onto something or not. It seems when it comes to leadership, say, in various, say, corporations or larger, what we would traditionally, what we think today as an organization, right? Some sort of company or something like that. It seems
a promise understood by a genus.
Correct. And it seems
an operational organization.
There we go. It seems that what tends to win the day in terms of leadership and leading those organizations towards, say, self-identified goals is a predominance of a posteriori knowledge, that everything is empirical. If we can't measure it, we don't want to do it. And when we're going to measure things, because mathematics, when we measure things, like outcomes that we're after, Then that's a way to settle disputes, because now your quote-unquote performance is about the mathematical computations I can perform on your work such that I can compare it to set goals to other workers. And since you can't really argue with me about basic math that 2 + 2 = 4, we found the mathematization of workforces, of organizations, highly attractive, because it appears as if, or the glamour of it is, it becomes indisputable, because you produced you produced 8 widgets, I produced 9, therefore I'm the better employee, and the leader who can lead more people to produce 9 widgets is a better leader. So everything around proper or intrinsic ends, the Aristotelian causes of formal or final causes, just seem to have dropped right out of, and this gets us back to the metaphysics, right?
Yes, it does.
Am I on to something, or am I like the king has no clothes?
Yeah, the ancient philosophy was chiefly interested in action.
Right.
Understanding what causes action, and action is related to the reality of aims. That there's an individual act that is most desired to be realized, to be brought into existence, either that or to be recognized as somehow causing relationships within things, so that you take multitudes and can somehow unite them into parts of a whole. Right. That's speculative philosophy. So metaphysics is simply the study of the principles of organizations, of all organizations that makes them operational organizations. So all of philosophy becomes easy. Right. When you're understanding it the way the ancient Greeks did it, and the way that I'm talking about it, and the problem with what you're just talking about is mathematicians are not interested in action.
Right.
They're interested in stopping action because that's the only way in which they can put things within dimensions, and place them within mathematical limits. But they can never make intelligible to you. The nature of activity. They can tell you how technologically to constrain it. How to develop an electrocardiogram to tell whether or not your effect on this material over there here will somehow be indicative, a sign of something going on internal to the thing. Whether you have a healthy heart or you don't have a healthy heart, or a blood pressure machine or a thermometer, okay? These are technologies that have mathematical markings on them in some way or relationship to those that can tell you about qualities. But ancient philosophy was interested in the reality of qualities. What organizations are interested in, businesses, every kind of human association is related to forming an organization. And to form an organization, you have to bring at least two people together with a common aim.
Right.
Largely, the whole notion of aims has been rejected by people who call themselves scientists today because they're chiefly interested in one aim, creating unity. And not action subsequent to the unity. This is deadly to people in businesses because what you're doing is you're taking methods for determining truth that have nothing to do with understanding what makes you great at performing an action.
Right. And
are these the themes you take up at the Aquinas Leadership Institute conference?
Yeah, well, it's the Aquinas School of Leadership, Management and Organizational Development. Yeah. That leaders are people who can form organizations and can establish a relationship within organizations, one of inequality, and distribute it throughout a multitude of unequally talented people.
Right, and you know the.
That's a real genius.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, and you know the lack of that I think comes up in if you look at something like the Occupy Wall Street movement, which was an attempt to
form. Good Lord.
Well, you know, right. when you look at what yeah. it was attempting to do, it was attempting to form this sort of global organization, but it was based solely on that premise of unity. So unity was the end in itself, and it was attempting to do this without any sense of a hierarchy. And without any sense of aims. And it ultimately, even though it brought a lot of people together, it was a failure because it wasn't directed towards any definite aims.
Yeah, well, you know, St. Thomas's chief interest, even though Adrian Gilson, who I greatly admire, you know, focused attention on this principle of the act of existing in St. Thomas, which is a dramatic discovery. But for St. Thomas, his chief object of interest was not existence. It was the same thing for the ancient Greeks. The ancient Greeks had no interest whatsoever in existence. They assumed that things exist. Okay,
it's usually by looking around.
Usually a safe assumption.
You ask the ancient Greeks, you know, what caused the universe to exist? The ancient Greek would say, "What do you mean? It's always been here."
Right.
always be here. And that's not the question. The question is, what causes things to be one, to be united? Right? St. Thomas's chief interest in science was understanding unity, the principles of unity, and no Thomistic scholar, aside from my colleague Charles Bonaventure Crowley, in the 20th century, examined St. Thomas's teaching about unity and the analogy of unity and how all of the sciences are dealing with principles of unity, because it's only by making something one or recognizing unity in things that you can form a concept and make judgments.
You know, I want to go back for a second to something you had said earlier about action, and we live in a world where there's almost kind of a crisis of understanding human action. You know, Margaret Anscombe, I think, brought this to the forefront in dealing with ethics, that without an understanding of human action, we really can't have any concept of ethics. And so I wanted to ask you about that. How do you move, I guess, from this understanding of action from a metaphysical standpoint to understanding action as sort of the basis and beginning of ethics?
Okay. Well, the only way that you can generate action is to the extent that you can have a principle, a source, a cause of action that's an organizational whole. That's a single being. That's a composite whole. This is St. Thomas's notion of form and matter. A composite whole that can be united into a single being in terms of taking opposites, joining them together so as to constitute abilities. You have to form relationships. You have to be able to take two things, right, that are independent one from another, unite them together, or not even two things, but two principles, a principle of organization or harmony that can be distributed throughout a multitude of unequally talented or powerful beings that can harmonize to be a source of action. Action presupposes a subject of action. Right? The only way you can define action is by relating it to a subject. The only way you can define a subject is by relating it to action. To get both of them together, you have to establish relationships. And relationships are established by qualities, by having qualities within abilities that can somehow be united proportionately one to another. Right? So that they can constitute a whole organization. St. Thomas gives the example of a crew team, for instance, where all the members of the crew team, under the direction of a leader, a coxswain, say, are rowing in the same direction, right? And are achieving a single act, winning the race, or a home builder who's unifying a multitude of qualitatively different activities to build this house, this numerically one house. In order to be able to reason in a fashion to do this, you have to have the skill of analogy. You have to be able to reason analogously. And one of the things I realized after reading Father Maurer and what he had said about philosophy, studying real genera, instead of, that is, operational organizations, multitudes that are generating action, not abstract universals. That's not what he's talking about. St. Thomas is not a moderate realist in this sense that 20th century Thomas talked about him. They don't understand his teaching about analogy, which chiefly refers to the ability of a multitude of different things or differently talented beings to generate one kind of action. So once you move St. Thomas's teaching into a habit of the soul, right? All of a sudden, Greek philosophy, the history of philosophy becomes radically changed. The whole history of philosophy has to be reconceived, looked at differently. It's false, the story about the nature of philosophy and so forth. And this is crucial because you can't be right about education in any kind of aspect, the development of cultural institutions, if you're wrong about human nature and you're wrong about human science.
So let me ask you, Dr. Redpath, having identified that as a very critical and large problem, what's being done about it?
Well, the only thing that I think that's chiefly being done about it is the ragamuffin Thomism and the ragamuffin ethics. There's a resurgence of interest in St. Thomas right now, universally, in Europe and in Asia and so on. And they're all going back to the same mistakes. And they're going back to the same people that they, that didn't understand St. Thomas's teaching during the 20th century, recovering their principles, and they think that they somehow or other are going to get a different result. You're going to get the same thing. Well, you're going to get bad colleges, bad universities. You're going to get presidents of Catholic universities, colleges, falsely so-called, who don't know what they're doing, and are seeking to evangelize people when they don't know what St. Thomas is teaching about a human being is, which is based upon the classical Greek understanding of the nature of the human person as it matured in Plato and Aristotle, which it was the foundation for the early teachings in the church about nature and grace. This whole new evangelization program is doomed to fail. It's a spinoff of Pope John Paul II, interest in new evangelization that he gave at Nowa Huta in Poland. But it's not going to go anywhere.
Right, not unless we can kind of recapture a proper understanding of what man is and what constitutes man and yeah, exactly, how man comes together to achieve certain ends.
For example, Hegelian idealist, neo-Gnostic spiritualist, German cardinals.
Right.
Explaining to you what Catholic theology is when they're basically Pelagians and Manichees. It's impossible.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's a kind of a massive rejection of philosophy for a while. You know, if you went to the academy, people would kind of look down on people that studied philosophy. You know, it's kind of a worthless, useless, you know, endeavor to a certain extent. And with that rejection of philosophy, you wound up with business schools, you wound up with engineering schools, you wound up with law schools to a certain extent, seeking out their own ends, seeking out their own aims, and kind of recreating to a certain extent their own disciplines. It seems like, you know, in that process, they may have inadvertently, accidentally gotten back to the process of true philosophy.
They did. Because what they wound up was developing psychology, modern psychology, which is largely worthless because You have fragments of this Aristotelian understanding of the human person that St. Thomas benignly reinterpreted. Huh?
Right. Rather than Hegel leading everybody astray, it was Freud that led everybody astray.
Yeah. But he's working off of Rousseau. Basically, Rousseau is the chief influence on Kant and Hegel and this whole movement in modern psychology, which comes out of Descartes. So what you had was the only people who were possessed of truth. One of the fundamental mistakes of this whole Cartesian revolution was this notion that science had to precede truth.
Right, right.
You had to somehow be able to demonstrate the first principles of reason, in order to have truth. So if you couldn't apply the scientific critique, the conscient critique, which is basically skepticism, to your way of thinking and reform it, according to this enlightened understanding of the human intellect, you could never have truth. And it's based upon presuppositions that they are considered evidently to be true that have never been justified. So the whole foundations of modern educational institutions coming out of the Enlightenment, they changed. They changed from educating people to develop different habits of the soul, to study different kinds of organizational wholes and arrive at analogous principles of truth, all unified through a chief science called metaphysics. And they reduced the whole of science to mathematical physics. They did a similar thing during the Renaissance, where the Renaissance humanists claimed that the whole of truth was contained in poetry.
Oh, right, yeah, yeah. I remember that. So let me ask you, Dr. Redpath. So Catholics who are listening, and others who are interested in trying to avoid some of these errors that seem to be very prevalent in our educational system. What are some avenues or places that one might go to avoid some of these errors and get an education or access educational materials or coursework that's not plagued by some of these problems that you've identified?
It's very difficult. You have to go back to classical learning. You have to train students in understanding I've been the chairman of the board of the Angelicum Academy homeschool program for about 15 years in order to recover an education of the principles that are the foundation for what Etienne Gilson, in his Unity of Philosophical Experience, calls the Western Creed, a classical understanding of the human person, and the faculty psychology that's related to that. So you've got to go back and you have to study the classics, among other things, from the foundation.
You know, and it's funny that classical education. My daughter is one of the students in the Angelicum Academy right now, and that classical education, when you start to build, I think that basis of understanding of who a human person is, the way you approach the world and the way you think about the world actually turns out to be a lot more, I think, practically oriented than people coming out of, I guess, what we would now call traditional educational institutions.
Common core, buddy.
But really, really modern, modernist, educational things. That, that classical education leads you towards aiming at certain ends. It leads you towards directing your actions in certain directions. It leads you towards a unified understanding of, I think, not only the universe, but human life as a unified whole, much more than the little fragmented bits and pieces of various sciences that you get kind of in a traditional educational setting.
Yeah, you have to return to a sense of realism. Modern philosophy, modern science, falsely so-called, doesn't do that. It starts with a kind of idealism, even though it pretends it doesn't. It starts with you're memorizing definitions, and you're taking for granted the fact opinion distinction, that facts are only what you can prove mathematically and so forth, and everything else is feelings or everything else is opinions. When you're studying classical thinking, there's this constant relationship between the reality of beings independent of human faculties and the faculties of the person, so that you develop a self-understanding, which Saint Thomas relates to a faculty which he calls particular reason, or the estimate of sense in animals, where people are aware of their own abilities, and they become increasingly aware of their abilities, and how these abilities are divided up into a kind of hierarchy and an order. St. Thomas's notion of principles, is not a bunch of premises that somehow you memorize. These are starting points, within people and things existing outside of human beings that are united together in an act of knowing. That act as the foundation for art and for science. So you have to return to the faculty psychology that's at the foundation of Western culture, that lies at the foundation of this Western creed, which maintains that human beings have the ability to know things independently of ourselves, which basically means we have the ability to know organizational natures, organizational wholes. We have ways of organizing our own internal psychology to do this, and to understand how these two extremes are related into a single understanding. That's what science is all about. Coming out of the Reformation and coming out of Cartesian thought, you have this skepticism that's taken over in Western culture, which denies to human beings personal abilities, by means of which we can know things independently of ourselves. That whole conscience fraud, we can't know things in themselves.
You
can't know organizations.
That's a huge problem, I think, that you've put your finger on. And the other problem we have, Dr. Redpath, is that we're out of time. We just feel like we just got started, but we're going to have to wrap things up with you. I feel like we've got, 10 miles to go, and we went about 3 feet. And so tell our audience, though, how they can follow up with you, the work that you're doing. Where can we get your books, your institutes? Where do we find information?
Well, if they Google my name, they'll find out a lot of information. Check out my webpage for the Aquinas School of Leadership, they'll get information there. I'm affiliated with this graduate program at Holy Apostles College and Seminary on
Great School. Yeah, great school. Yeah,
graduate program. And these books are being published by Enroute, Enroute Books and Media. The two volumes are Not So Elementary Christian Metaphysics and the Moral Psychology of St. Thomas Aquinas, an introduction to Ragamuffin Ethics.
I love that. Excellent. Well, thank you so much for being on the program. We love having you in the cave. You're super busy. You got a gazillion things going on. So we appreciate you taking the time. We want to wish you a blessed Advent, Merry Christmas, and then hopefully we'll catch up with you again real soon in the new year.
Oh, yeah. That I think my Ragamuffin Ethics text will be coming out should be out by January, and it's about 800 pages long.
Wow. Okay,
yeah,
well, there
quite,
we go.
Quite a read, so very good.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Redpath. God bless.
Same to you. Merry Christmas to you and your audience.
Celebrating the moment heaven touched earth with divine rescue.
Jesus, from the cradle to the cross. The greatest story of love, remembered daily.
Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle, still here with Timothy O'Donnell and Kent Blanford. And unfortunately, Dr. Peter Redpath had to leave, but that was a fantastic interview we just had with him. And, it takes a little bit of translation, I think, to get back down.
Unpacking
what he's saying. But, funny thing is when you do that, when you actually understand what is being said there, it's so eminently practical. And you're talking about something like metaphysics where, the reputation is, metaphysics is very ethereal and the opposite of practical, and yet
navel gazing.
Yeah, yeah, and yet, you know, when you start looking at it as, you know, this bringing a sense of wholeness to an organization and the understanding of organizations and how organizations of things are put together. When you start to understand metaphysics that way, it leads you very quickly to the understanding of philosophy as a practical science, as an understanding of how to get from point A to point B, all the ingredients that we're going to need, how, you know, all the different ducks in a row that we're going to need to get there, and you know, it turns philosophy, the whole philosophical endeavor, away from simply, you know, trying to understand the starry skies above us or the moral law within us. It turns it to trying to understand practically, okay, who, what, when, where, why, and how do I need to be able to get there?
Exactly. I loved his analogies of both, you know, you think of that sort of rowing team that's in a competition, you know, with the one goal of one end in mind of winning the race, but the organization and the skill that it takes, that habit of soul in order to compete and to form over time the kind of habits that allow you to become excellent, and then you possess that excellence, and the kind of pleasure that comes along with acquiring, you know, having acquired virtue. I think it was really very, very helpful for what we're trying to get at around this crisis of metaphysics, and the fact that one of the crisis I think Dr. Redpath is speaking about that he's identified is this idea that a lot of things we've talked about, ends and purposes, have kind of fallen out of our thinking, that there are generally speaking, and so there's this, I love his phrase about how the project of science these days is really to, you know, it's a mathematized physics that tortures nature,
right,
to reveals its secrets. I love that
phrase.
Well,
and that's not his phrase. That's from Roger Bacon, who's one of the founders of modern science. I mean,
that's
the goal modern science sets for itself. That's not Dr. Redpath. So, yeah.
And it's a great reminder. And in that conversation with Dr. Redpath, you know, it serves to remind us that you think about a lot of just kind of the state of affairs that we're in. Much of what science seems to be doing these days seems to ignore the nature of things, the intrinsic goods, and simply everything is completely mutable. Everything is completely changeable. Everything is clay, and it's just simply up to us to develop enough techniques and know-how to form things into what we want them to be.
Right.
This creates the conditions for a lot of fluidity around things, like say for gender identity or something like that, where it's nothing sort of given. It's rather, it's what I sort of posit or what I assert, because everything's clay, so everything's malleable.
Right. Rather than trying to understand the things as they are, understanding their natures, understanding what they're here for to a certain extent, so that we can better organize them. So, you know, rather than, as you said, you know, torturing nature to be able to get it to do what we want, we're simply organizing what's already exists in nature with a better understanding of it.
I think, too, he didn't mention by name, but I know we don't try to do a lot of name drawing, but he is the rector of the Adler Aquinas Institute. So Adler's for Dr. Mortimer Adler, that great philosopher and education.
Aristotelian. And he was really responsible for, I think, bringing Aristotle back to the popular, you know, popular understanding of Aristotle.
One of his great life's project, we might see, is the Great Books of Western Civilization,
right?
Which that those texts that there's a 54 volume and a 60 volume version. I have the 60 volume version myself, which you can get off eBay, by the way, or Amazon. But that it's all that collection of readings throughout all of Western civilization, the last 2,500 years, is the foundation of that classical education that he was talking about, right?
Right, I mean, exactly.
When we think about the Angelicum, isn't that?
Angelicum Academy follows that great books collection almost verbatim as far as the books that they go through.
Well, there's so much more we can do, but I think we're out of time.
We are out of time for this week. That's it for the Catholic Cave. We will join you again next week. Until next time, may God bless.
Thanks for joining us for this edition of the Catholic Cave. If you have a question or comment regarding this program, please address an email to Kent, K-E-N-T, at catholicradioindy.org or call 317-870-8400. Replays of this program are available on podcast at catholicradioindy.org. Just click on the programming tab then go to podcasts of local programs.